Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking with Hirokazu Yoshikawa about his book, Immigrants Raising Citizens, Undocumented Parents and Their Young Children. I'd like now to welcome to the program Brooke Singer. She is an artist. She is in residency at the Santa Fe Art Institute, and she will be speaking this Friday at 6 o'clock at Tipton Hall. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
And Michelle LaFlamme-Childs from the Santa Fe Art Institute joins us. Welcome.
Thank you. It's nice to be around.
So, Brooke, you have a lot of different projects that you've done, a lot of work, some of which you're showing at the Santa Fe Art Institute, and I thought maybe we could start with some of your photography. You have photographed Superfund sites.
Right.
Tell us about how that whole thing got started. What's it all about?
Sure. In 2007, I began a project called Superfund 365, and that was a online data visualization application where I, for a year, every day, would highlight a different Superfund site. And basically, I got interested in Superfund sites having a conversation with the former ombudsman of the EPA. His name is Robert Martin. And I was talking with him about a different project I was doing at the time in 2006 with my collective Preemptive Media. We were trying to build air monitoring devices that people could use around New York City and basically monitor air pollution on their own. And
how did that work out?
It worked. It was a long year of research and development. There are three of us, Beatrice DaCosta, Jamie Schulte, and myself. And around that time in 2006, there were these new sensors that were cheap and enabled individuals, people familiar with physical computing, to basically build their own air monitoring devices that would monitor ozone or carbon monoxide, carbon dioxide, that kind of thing. So we're commissioned by the Lower Manhattan Cultural Council and IMBEEP Art and Technology in New York City to build a social sculpture installation, a public art installation, and we decided to do this air monitoring project. The commission asked us to address an issue in Lower Manhattan, and in 2005, 2006, we felt like we couldn't really talk about, do a public art piece without somehow addressing 9/11. And so this was our way of entering that conversation. So anyway, I met with Robert Martin and we started talking about air monitoring and post 9/11, the World Trade Center dust, which he was intimately involved with as in his former position as ombudsman at the EPA. And he said something to me which was quite jarring, which was the first week after the World Trade Center collapsed, there were people inside the EPA who were mobilizing to declare all of Lower Manhattan a Superfund site. And as a New Yorker and as an artist who was doing an air monitoring project, I knew that was a very strong and kind of extreme statement, but I didn't really understand what it meant for a place to be declared a Superfund site. So I got online and discovered the CERCLIS database, which basically is the EPA database with all of its information about Superfund sites. And I found it dull and very technical and hard to kind of get through, very obtuse. And this data visualization project I did, Superfund 365, was my response.
And so what did you do?
What did I do? I pulled in the EPA data into an application and basically visualized the worst Superfund sites, so 365 out of, say, 1,300 on the national priorities list. And I was showing what contaminants were present at these sites, who was responsible, the local demographics of the area. I would pull in maps from Google Maps. And it was really important for me to make the information engaging. And I did that through making it visually impactful, beautiful, you might say, some would say. And also did a lot of explaining through a key to make technical jargon kind of more understandable. But a big part of that project for me was to make the information commentable and allow people to add their own text and images. So it was a growing archive, and it was both official data, and over time it would become also full of user contributed information.
So what was the photography aspect of it?
So the photography aspect, first it was just me visiting the sites as I would highlight a different site each day. I started in New York, and it was like a travelogue, and I worked myself, the project worked itself across the country. And I would visit many of the sites and bring a point-and-shoot camera. And my background is in photography. My undergraduate degree is in photography, so I love it and I take it seriously. But for this project, it was more of just getting information and adding information to this growing archive. But then these sites were really visually fascinating to me. A lot of times I'd get to a place and there was no indication that there were toxic hazards in the area. There might be a fence, there might be a do not enter private property sign, but hardly ever, maybe once, I saw an EPA Superfund site sign. Sometimes I came across huge shopping malls or just a paved block, like an erased block in the middle of a thriving city. So I started to see or feel that documenting, visually documenting, and turning this into a photography project was really important and interesting to me. And it also conveyed the information in a very different way than showing the data and illustrating the data on a website. So after the year from 2007 to 2008, when the data visualization application ended, I felt like my work had actually just begun, and the photography was an outgrowth of that web application.
Give us an example of like a place that you visited, the kind of toxicity that was there, and the awareness or non-awareness in that community.
Sure. One site I visited early on was the U.S. Radium Corporation in East Orange, New Jersey. And that site's very near Thomas Edison's factory in Edison, New Jersey. So historically, the area is very interesting in terms of innovation. And when I did my research before I got to the location, there was tons of information, mostly in academic journals, about U.S. radium, because this was a site where in the 19-teens, the U.S. Radium Corporation was hiring mostly women to paint military instruments with what was the first technology for glow-in-the-dark, which was basically paint laced with radium.
And they would wet the paintbrushes with their tongues.
Exactly. Yeah. Do this technique called lip pointing, where they would lick the paintbrushes and ingest radium, and they would then suffer fractured jaws, severe anemia, and some had cancers and died. And so a lot of labor laws came out of this this incident. And also, it was very early on in terms of understanding what radiological material did to materials and to the human body. So when I got there, I expected there to be all kinds of memorials and signs and understanding, you know, just like the Thomas Edison Museum not far away. But what I found when I got there was a paved block in the middle of East Orange. And there's a fence around it. There's no sign. And I did go into a local barber shop where a bunch of people were hanging out and talking, and some were getting their hair cut, and told them about my photography project and how I was photographing just next door. And no one in that barber shop knew the history of U.S. radium. So to me, this is all very interesting, not only the history, but what you find present day, and also what's projected on the site for the future, and is that site ever going to be developed and taken back into the community and livable again?
So as an example, that's a site that, what, is it still toxic or not anymore?
Well, there is toxic material underneath the pavement. So I did talk to a local official in East Orange, and there are plans to perhaps turn that into a park or a basketball court. But you couldn't, he said, turn it into a garden because the hazardous material is about a foot under that pavement, that asphalt. There are elevated levels of radiation in the community, and those are still being remediated and taken care of. Although, you know, the site has been in cleanup for 30 years. So the EPA, the under Superfund, is on the tail end, is closing out that cleanup process.
So that's just one example of many. You did a project where you visualized this and made that boring, inaccessible data available to more people. Does the EPA, for example, have any interest in linking to your work? I mean, can you, if you just Google this, get to your work as well as that boring data?
Sure. And I actually, from my site, if you Google Superfund, I actually don't know what comes up. I haven't done that in a while. But if you go to my site, I do link directly to the CERCLIS, to the EPA database, and the other databases. I am pulling information from the Agency for Toxic Substances Disease Registry, and there is census data, and I do link to all of the raw data. The EPA, I have, not until actually being here in Santa Fe, I have not been in direct conversation with the EPA about my project. While I was here, I went to a conference at La Fonda Hotel. It was for the, let me see if I can get this right, the Earth Science Data Information Group, I think it's something along those lines. But there are folks there from the EPA. It's where a lot of scientific researchers come together and talk about issues like data visualization and data quality. And someone I know who is a member of this this group who was speaking at the conference found out I was here, so last minute pulled me in, which was very exciting for me. And I presented the Superfund 365 project, and an individual from the EPA was there, and we had a long discussion afterwards. I was pushing for the EPA to release their data more often, and also to release their data in a standard that's more up to date, because believe it or not, the government is not releasing the data in forms that are really kind of are easily usable for a web service like what I created with Superfund 365. So it was an interesting conversation. I had heard from, you know, through other people, the EPA responding to my website, that they thought that the website did a very good job of showing their inaccuracies, which is kind of an interesting comment. And then another individual who had been at the EPA and talking about data visualization and their data plans and how to release their information and make it public, that they actually cited my project as the future of data visualization and ways to share data with public.
Do you get the sense that they're interested in doing it and just haven't gotten around to it, or they really don't want to make that data available to the public in a way that the public can understand?
I think it's a mix of both, and depending, you know, the EPA is a large agency, and I think people have different ideas and plans and motivations. I think that under the Obama administration, there's actually been a much larger emphasis on open government and making data accessible. Data.gov is a great example, and I think it was on day one of Obama's administration, he released a memo saying that data should be made accessible and available to the public in a speedy and kind of up-to-date format. There's still, it took me 3 months to acquire all the data I needed for this website, even though it was publicly available. It was dispersed. It was not all in one location for me to download. I had to talk to many individuals. When I got the information from CERCLIS, I found that all the contaminant data was missing. So I had to actually call each manager of each EPA manager for each site and get the contaminant data. Everyone was perfectly happy to work with me, and were very nice, but it just was a lot of work. Sometimes the information came in a PDF, so I'd had to copy and paste it into my database instead of having streaming data in a form like XML. I don't want to get too technical here, but a lot of the conversation I have when I'm talking about Superfund 365 is how public is our public data and how we can make it even more public through applications like Superfund 365.
I think it's amazing that a media artist ends up being the person that makes science data available to the public. And maybe not amazing. Maybe that's who should be hired to do that kind of work on every level, is they should be hiring artists rather than technicians or bureaucrats or whatever to actually, if they have an interest in doing it, we, the public, certainly, I would think, have the sense that there is public interest in doing so. But if they want to make it available to us, artists are better positioned than almost anybody else to do so.
Well, I think artists are in a really unique position to push forward and kind of advance the whole field of data visualization because, you know, look, artists have been in the game of representation or taking really complex information and reducing it to an engaging kind of human, human scale for a very long time. You know, artists are also obviously good at the game of aesthetics and making things beautiful, but you can also think about this as artists entering the public sphere and being instigators and making interventions into not only public space in a physical kind of way, but more of a virtual kind of way.
And also kind of bridging the perceived gaps between art and science, art and technology.
Sure, yeah. That's really important. And I think that I just want to make a point that I don't think the EPA per se should be in the game of making data visualizations. I think what I think what the EPA and other government agencies should be doing is making very accessible their information and making it available in a format that anyone can make these visualizations and take in information from various sources and create their own representations. You know, if the EPA wants to create their own visualizations beyond what's available in, like, the CERCLIS database, then I'm all for it. But I think really the most important thing is that the data is there, that's in a, that it's correct, that it's constantly updated, and it's in a standard that is, you know, contemporary and that people can use for all these, you know, mashups and newfangled applications that are going on online.
So on Friday night when you were at Tipton Hall at 6 o'clock, you will be showing your photographs. We're talking to Brooke Singer about her Superfund 365 project, which is what you will be talking about. So you'll be showing these, is it three, really 365 photos or 365 sites that you took photos of?
Well, the photography project is actually a distillation of the archives. So I'm aiming to photograph somewhere between 25 to 30 sites. What's important for me in the photo series is to kind of come to some sort of conclusion, show patterns that I've discovered along the way by kind of living and breathing this archive for so long, and also highlight the stories of amazing people and communities and organizations that I've been in contact with because of this project. So I will, online I have about 10 to 12 sites, samples of photographs from 10 to 12 sites. And I'll speak about some of those and others in my presentation on Friday.
There's also a rotoscoping workshop that you and your husband are going to be doing. Michelle, do you want to... Brooke and her husband, but Michelle, you tell us a little bit about it.
Yeah, Brooke and her husband, Ricardo Miranda Zuniga, are doing a rotoscoping workshop, which is a video animation technique that is now done primarily on computer, but was originated by drawing an image on top of a cell of a piece of film. So things like the AHA video would be an example, actually, of something like rotoscoping. And there are lots of cool other ones, actually. If you go to the SFAI blog, which is sfaiblog.org, those guys' information is up first, and there are lots of links to some really great examples of rotoscoping. That workshop will be happening on the 30th and 31st of this month, which is this coming weekend, from 10 to 2 each day, and it will happen at the Santa Fe University of Art and Design's Moving Image Arts Lab because they have all that cool equipment.
Ah, very nice. Well, Brooke Singer is an artist. Her website is bsing.net, and we will see you at Tipton Hall on Friday, the 29th of July, 6 o'clock, sponsored by the Santa Fe Art Institute. Thank you both very much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte.
We're going to take a break. We'll be back in just a moment. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome to the program Hirokazu Yoshikawa. He's Academic Dean of Harvard University's Graduate School of Education. He is author of the book Immigrants Raising Citizens, Undocumented Parents and Their Young Children. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much for having me.
So in all the media conversation about undocumented immigrants here in the United States, there is very little about their documentation status and how that affects their children. How did you come to write about immigration from this perspective?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I don't think in much of the public discussion about the undocumented as either lawbreakers or as victims that there's a recognition that they are parents who are raising 4.5 million citizen children in the United States. And this was not a topic that we expected the study to be all about when we started it. This was a study of hundreds of families in New York City, born in public hospitals there, and it's the book is part of a much larger study about culture and context and how they influence children's development in immigrant families. But basically, as they told their stories of immigration, this emerged as a very powerful theme. And it turns out that growing up with a parent without papers, these kids are at risk for lower cognitive development as early as at 24 months, simply because their parents have no papers and these kids are not accessing learning opportunities as a result.
You compare Dominican, Mexican, and Chinese families with small children. Why these three groups?
We happen to pick those three groups in New York City because they represent the majority of immigrant families in New York, and together they make up nearly half of the city's population. So that's basically why we picked the group. Now, it turns out their histories of when they started to come to New York and the proportions of undocumented parents among these groups are really different. With the Dominicans really starting to come in large waves about 50 or 60 years ago in New York. And so having much more multi-generational networks, ethnic enclaves that are really rich and provide a lot of support that have built up over decades, both the Mexicans and the low-income Chinese who have come as large recent waves of migration to New York City have been much higher proportions undocumented, coming largely after the 1986 to 88 Immigration Reform and Control Act, which was the last time that there was a pathway to citizenship for the undocumented. So for these groups, they have come, they're generally stable two-parent families, but they haven't had access to a pathway to citizenship.
You write about undocumented parents living a paradox, and that paradox is that the same government that can deport them also offers them services. Tell us about these services. Which ones are most effective for parents and their small children, and to what extent do undocumented parents access them for their citizen children?
Yeah, so hundreds of studies show that for kids in low-income families, a good center-based child care program in the first years of life can really improve their early learning, their language, literally can result in larger vocabularies. And the undocumented parents in our study were afraid to access child care subsidies, which would help them to pay for what's often very expensive center-based care. Any of your listeners who are listening who have young kids between the ages of 0 and 3 recognize how expensive a good child care program can be. And so the child care subsidies that would help these parents purchase good child care for their citizen children, they were afraid to sign their kids up for this because it would require reporting their earnings and identifying their employer often. So This was something that they were reluctant to do, despite the fact that their earnings were so low and would qualify their children for child care subsidies, and despite the fact that they were working usually 12-hour days, 6 days a week. That was a very typical scenario for our fathers or mothers in our sample.
Are there safeguards in, at least in New York, in the places that you studied, so that if people want to access them, they're not in danger of being deported or turned in?
So New York City happens to be a sanctuary city, which means that local law enforcement officials don't stop parents simply by virtue of kind of suspicion of having come into the country outside the law or without papers. And so New York, compared to many other policy contexts, and of course with states like Arizona and Georgia and other states in this country passing much harsher laws, we saw these really negative impacts on kids and, you know, higher parental stress and lower access to these resources and supports in a fairly generous policy environment. So I can only imagine that these patterns are worse in policy contexts that are harsher.
The whole issue of depression and anxiety and the effect of those things on small children, I think, is something one just doesn't think about if you're not in that world. Tell us about that. In other words, what are the people that you studied, what are they anxious and, well, I mean, it's kind of obvious, but explain to us, what are they anxious and depressed about, and how does that affect their small children?
Yeah, so I think what we see among undocumented families is this pileup of stress from both the economic conditions that they live under, which, you know, many, many families, certainly, especially right now in the United States, are feeling that kind of economic stress. So the day-to-day stresses of being able to make ends meet, of pinching pennies, of wondering whether the paycheck is going to last till the next one, these were part of the stresses. So those are kind of economic and financial stresses. But I think there was this also this kind of background hum in their lives, which was the fear of deportation and the recognition that they did not want to access formal institutions, public services. They were not using public services or programs that their children were eligible for. And in the case of a child care and center-based care, that ended up being to the detriment, you know, harming their children's early learning. But so I think it's this combination of stress from living under the radar and the economic stresses of living in poverty, extremely long work hours. Between a third and 40% of these moms and dads were working under the minimum wage, working illegally low wages, working for years, often 12 or 15 years at the same job without getting a raise. So just to give an example, one of our Mexican dads who had been doing deliveries for a deli 12 hours a day, 6 days a week, had injured both of his knees through wintertime falls on the New York City ice. As his older kids got to the age where they understood what he did for work, he was ashamed to tell them that he was still a delivery boy after 12 years working for the same deli. This dad, like many undocumented parents, was paying taxes and waiting for a work visa. And, of course, there was none coming. He had not asked for a raise, so many of these parents, the employers are not giving them raises, but the workers are also not asking for raises. So there's a kind of a toxic relationship of indebtedness and exploitation in these workplaces, which ultimately is harmful for kids' development. So when a family's economic conditions are stagnant, with wages not changing for periods of 10, 12, 15 years, whether it's a recession or not, that is simply not good for kids' development.
We're talking to Hiro Yoshikawa about his book, Immigrants Raising Citizens, Undocumented Parents and Their Young Children. New Mexico is one of the few states that does offer driver's licenses to undocumented immigrants. In other words, they're documented with identification from their own country, but they're not of green card status here.
Mm-hmm.
What happens to people who don't have driver's licenses in states that don't, which is almost every state of the country? How does that affect individuals and families not to have a driver's license?
So in other studies I've conducted, the role of having a driver's license and then a car and then a working car is the lifeline of low-wage work. So without that, in most areas of this country, you're simply dead in the water as far as access to any kind of choice, even within the low-wage job market. So certainly right now, many, many people are unemployed regardless of whether they have a car. But if there are jobs out there, if you don't have a car, you're not going to be able to access them. So this current study that I did was conducted in New York City, which is a bit unusual in the sense that it has a very good public transportation system. But for the undocumented parents in our sample who were living outside of New York City, there was an additional layer of kind of isolation and almost desperation. So a parent who was basically stuck in a suburban house. Her husband had a car, but she had none, and so she could not get out. She could not run any household errands without access to her husband's car. And so she had felt really quite sequestered and depressed as a result of that, because she herself could not drive. So, you know, a driver's license also has importance for accessing all kinds of resources. So for our parents, there was a combination of both not having these kinds of formal symbols of belonging in the United States, but also low levels of information. So a surprising number of our undocumented parents did not know about public libraries, for example, in their communities, didn't know about programs like Head Start, preschool programs for their kids that would improve their development. So in some cases, our interviewers were the first people to even tell these parents about the existence of things like public libraries.
What are the services that the people in your study did tend to access most?
So the undocumented parents in our study actually, interestingly, had the highest rates of church attendance. So they were attending church really regularly. Many of the countries from which undocumented parents come in Latin America or elsewhere, these are highly religious families where the families were going together to church on Sundays. So that was an aspect of their lives that was where they were, interestingly, even more connected than our documented parents. So there's a lot I talk at the end of the book about what we can all do to help the learning and the development of these citizen children. So 4.5 million citizen kids of the undocumented are key to the nation's economy. It's a large group. They're going to school right alongside all the other citizen kids in our country. So we really need to be concerned about their learning opportunities, particularly in the first years of life when brains are developing so quickly. So I think one way that we can think about this is through the community organizations that serve low-income immigrant families, and churches are really key to that. And to the degree that we can support the ability of churches and other local organizations to provide information, basic information that we take for granted, whether it's about public libraries or preschools or childcare, and then later on about the school systems and the basic information about how to navigate a public school system. These are things that can really make a difference for these kids.
There's also the WIC program, which I understand from your book is pretty well utilized.
In New York City, it was, and that was because I think the sign-up for this program was in the public hospitals. It was done right at the child's birth by social workers. It was done very quickly at the time that health insurance coverage was being assessed. So, and that's a real no-brainer from a policy perspective, in that the WIC program improves infant health reduces neonatal problems, reduces infant mortality, pays for itself in terms of its benefits to society. So it is very important that these kids access WIC. But that might not be true in other parts of the country. So I would just put in a caution there that in New York City, where we collected the data, it happened to be these hospitals were very effective at signing these families up for WIC, but that might not be true everywhere.
Undocumented workers tend to do what you call the worst jobs in urban America. Long hours, as you've talked about, rough working conditions, low wages, sometimes wage theft. They're working below the minimum wage, which is not legal, but they're afraid to say anything. To what extent are they able to get any kind of worker protection to join unions, and to what extent are they able to advance into better jobs?
So in our study, they were not advancing into any better jobs within even a fairly restricted workplace as far as income, like a restaurant. They were generally working the very lowest tier of jobs without the possibility of moving up, even within that kind of environment. Now, of course, in different parts of the country, these jobs are really different, but the evidence shows that these are national studies, not the study that I conducted, but the national studies show that the undocumented in every industry are at the very bottom. So in construction, they are doing the drywall installation. They are not doing the jobs. They're doing the jobs where they are receiving instructions but not having reciprocal interactions with very much with coworkers or supervisors. So they do not have the access to developing new skills generally at jobs. They cannot sit for GEDs. They don't qualify for federal workforce assistance or job training. So this is a population that our national public policies exclude from workforce development and the opportunity to better their lives. Now, they themselves are, of course, undocumented. In the book, I show that what the consequences are for their citizen children. As far as unionization goes, that's been difficult in New York City with low-income immigrant workers, but it really varies in different parts of the country. So Los Angeles is a historically very well-known example of a place where in a city, occupations like janitors, low-income, low-wage jobs with high concentrations of low-income immigrants, there have been successful unionization efforts.
The book focuses on how all of this affects their children, and I think it's important to talk specifically about what happens between the ages of 0 and 3 or 4 years old when kids don't get the stimulation and nurturing that they need.
Yeah, so literally their vocabularies are smaller, which places them at risk for problems right at school entry, but even on into later schooling. And what we know from national data suggests that these kids are particularly likely to go into lower quality schools, lower resourced schools in low income neighborhoods. So their prospects are really not good in terms of their long term school success. And this is a period when the development of brain architecture is extremely critical. If you don't have those foundations well laid down solidly with these indicators like early language development, then there's long-term risks for these kids' school success and even their employability and job success in the future. So the larger economic context for this concern is that we as a country can't afford to be writing off millions of citizen children simply because their parents have no papers. So at a time when our economy is aging so rapidly, and we really need to maximize the potential of every kid to help support the rest of us as we get older, this is a population we really need to pay some attention to.
We're talking to Hiro Yoshikawa about the book Immigrants Raising Children. When you compared the children of documented immigrants and undocumented immigrants specifically, did you find out that, I mean, both of them doing perhaps pretty rough jobs, did the kids of immigrants with papers end up doing better?
Yes, the evidence from this study suggests that they did. It is because even though our entire sample was low income, and so even, let's say, comparing the jobs, the all of our parents were in the low-wage workforce, the rates of illegally low wages were much higher among the undocumented parents. So that's one indicator. As I said before, the access to childcare subsidies. So if you simply looked at the parents who had already chosen to put their children into center-based care, the undocumented parents still had much, much lower rates of use of access to childcare subsidies. So those are two of the indicators that were really of concern for these families. And as we also talked about a little bit, the levels of stress also seem to be different. And I think it is because it's the combination of the stress from economic conditions and pretty deep poverty, but on top of that, the stresses of living under the radar and being undocumented in the United States.
You know, just knowing that ICE can come and knock on your door and take you away at any moment is, depending on when the last time it was that it happened in your community, a high or medium low-level stress all the time.
That's right, and I think other studies, we had, thankfully, very few reports of actual deportation or knowing someone who was deported, but our study was conducted several years ago, and so now we know that rates of deportation have increased in this country, and so many more immigrant families know someone or have themselves experienced deportation. And there have been a couple studies of that experience and its effects on families and children, and the effects, of course, on the economic conditions of an arrest like that because of the loss of income are drastic. So families losing 100% of their income or half their income overnight. But then the level of fear in these families and the rates of keeping children at home, in that case, very high rates of kind of behavior problems, anxiety problems in the kids are a huge issue for those families that are directly affected by deportation. And for those who aren't affected, there is still this sense of the fear of what might happen.
To what extent do extended families, grandmothers and grandfathers and aunts and uncles and so on, make up for a lot of these other problems that come with long hours and lack of resources and things like that?
Yeah, so extended families and, in fact, friendships can make a huge difference, and grandparents, of course. And what was interesting was that our groups that had the highest rates of undocumented status, which were, again, the most recent low-income waves of migration from Mexico and China to New York City, because they had come, they had, as immigrant groups, they had just started coming in the early 90s, our parents were often the first people in their families to come. And because they were unable to get green cards or have any kind of sponsoring role, they could not bring their own parents, who would be the grandparents of the kids, over. So they were much less likely to have grandparents in the home than, for example, our Dominican families. So there was kind of a double whammy of not having access to grandparents. The undocumented families often were doubled up just to make ends meet in a really expensive city, and so they had more adults in the home, but paradoxically less support available to help with their kids. So when we ask questions, you know, who do you have in your, who you know who could help with taking care of your child if you had to go away for a couple of days, help with finding a job, help making ends meet, our undocumented families, despite having more adults in the home, had lower levels of that kind of support. And that's because they didn't have the kinds of folks like grandparents who might have the time and the dedication to take care of their kids. The other adults in their households were often other undocumented young adults working those very, very long work hours. So it was no wonder they were unavailable to help our parents.
Now, my own grandparents came to the United States from Sicily in the first part of the 20th century. My grandparents, all of their brothers and sisters, all of them made it. It wasn't easy, but all of them made it. My father went to college, and basically any of their kids who wanted to did go to college. So some did, a lot didn't. What's the difference between that era and today? This was also New York City. What is similar? What is different?
Yeah, in some ways there are certainly parallels. In every age, we have the low-income, often marginalized group that has come in. So certainly the marginalized immigrant groups at the in the first decades of the 20th century were from Southern Europe, from Italy, from Ireland, from Eastern Europe. They were discriminated against. Their experiences were what led to the labor laws, for example, of this country. So the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire, in which over 140 primarily immigrant young women died, was one instance of terrible work conditions leading to public policy change. So one way in which things should have changed for the better is that we now have some public policies like laws governing workplace violations, and yet we find that workplace violations are still rampant for the population of undocumented immigrant workers in this country, and that's a major problem that needs to be fixed. The other thing is that in doing the research for this book, I learned that the category of undocumented or illegal immigrant was invented in 1888 under the Chinese Exclusion Act, singling out a single ethnic group for this status. And so for much of the development of this country, there was no such category as illegal immigrant.
If you could just basically wave a magic wand and have immigration policy, just on simply the level of what happens to immigrants, documentation status, things like that, when they do get here, especially from the perspective of helping future citizens, if you could change that to be something which you think is really reasonable, what would it look like?
So one option would be what President George W. Bush proposed in 2006, which is a pathway to citizenship for families who have demonstrated a certain number of years of residence in the U.S. And by the way, all of our undocumented parents had been in the U.S. for multiple years before having their first child, so this was not an anchor baby situation. But then President Bush proposed, and many folks from across both parties in Congress at that point were in agreement that these parents would not go to the front of the line. They would go to the back of the line in terms of a wait for something like a green card. They would pay a fine. They would demonstrate that they had been working during their years in the U.S., as the vast majority of the undocumented are in fact doing, many of them paying taxes. So that's certainly a set of policies that was proposed seriously only 5 years ago.
Hirokazu Yoshikawa is Academic Dean of Education at Harvard University's Graduate School of Education, and he's author of the new book, Immigrants Raising Citizens, Undocumented Parents and Their Young Children. Thanks so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks so much for having me. It was terrific.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.